Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris, equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thanks so much for joining us. Once again, we're joined by Mike Cantu, property buyer, investor, builder, developer, and property manager, and he is one of the best in the business in California. Mike, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the introduction, Bruce.
You know, it can be a little intimidating when somebody goes to a club and they hear, you know, the Mike Cantu story or the Tony Alvarez story or whoever's story that has been a great success and they have amassed wealth. There might be an assumption that going forward, you would have a very a difficult time accomplishing the same thing in the next 10-year cycle that you had in the last 10. What's your feeling on that?
I think there's always an opportunity out there, and when they hear my story, I try and make it loud and clear that it's not all good, that I have forever had the wrong dance step. It's always been three steps forward, two back, three forward, two back. I would have been done with this business many years ago and off on some tropical island had I been able to eliminate the two steps back part of it. So for everything I've done good, I've gone backwards a little bit also. So it's been a steady but uphill climb.
It's an interesting statement. Now, you're certainly capable of being done and decided not to be done. So, in other words, I don't know that you're willing to take that walk away from the business because maybe you don't have a replacement for it.
You're right. As much as I harbor that fantasy of someday being done and everything else, I realize that I do have a little bit of obsessive compulsive in me. And when that kicks in, I think, no, I love this business. And it's not, the money certainly has a part to do with it, but it's the game that I love, and I love playing the game every day. I come to work with the attitude, I don't want to work, I want to do real estate.
You know, I get a sense, too, that you're about to, and it's almost a game, and I mean, you and I haven't talked about this, but this is my sense, that you have pile number one, and pile number two is now about to be accumulated and duplicate pile number one, and yet I don't know that any of the assets will play a role in you accomplishing pile number two. Is that a good guess?
Absolutely. The existing assets will have nothing to do with the new pile. Those are just not in the equation anymore.
And I guess really that was why that original comment, there will be people that look, let's say, over the next 10 years, and let's say you end up with another pile of properties if it's in the high desert or whatever, and their conclusion would be, well, that's because he had all that stuff in Ontario. That would be a very wrong conclusion.
Absolutely. My attitude was at the beginning of 2006, I started real estate over. I took the good properties, took them off the table, and thought, okay, I've got some leveraged properties left, and I've got some money in the bank here, and let's start this game over again.
So I guess what we're saying is what you're attempting to accomplish, let's say in this next cycle, would be also possible for somebody that didn't necessarily have great wealth, but access to money and the skill to pull off good buys.
Absolutely. It was more of a challenge to myself, thinking, okay, I'm going to start just like everybody else does. I know I have some more experience and the luxury of making all of the mistakes that I've learned so much from, but yeah, I think the only difference is I've got a little bit more experience than some of these people, but I'm starting at the same level they are.
How important in buying is the attitude that they have, or that you have what they want, not the opposite way?
I think your attitude as a buyer is the most important thing. You can have all of the other stuff mastered, but if you have the wrong attitude, you're not going to get anywhere in this business. Attitude is everything, and that was the class that I taught a few weeks ago. That was the only chapter, and I broke it into two halves, some morning attitude and some afternoon attitude, whereas everything else was just one chapter. That was, to me, that is absolutely the most important thing out there, is having the right attitude. I know that's what got me through the down cycle. It's what pulled me out of all of my big messes and kept me going. If I had the wrong attitude, I'd probably have a job somewhere and be doing bumper-to-bumper traffic every day.
You know, when most people talk to real estate agents and then they say, you know, the I word, I'm an investor, there's a disconnect and there's an assumption that we're taking advantage of or about to make a lowball offer. And that's almost impossible for many of the buyers to get past that, to where the realtors understand that we bring something to the party that no one else does. During a cycle that we're about to experience, How do you get past that initial attitude, or do you just don't care and you make an offer, and if they get upset, they tough?
That's exactly it. See, in dealing with a real estate agent, I have the luxury of the agent that I use. And John is just an all-star agent. He pretty much represents my own stuff, and he's the one that gets beaten up. I never understood why John had to take a nap about 1 o'clock every day, and then I watched him in action from about 8:30 until noon, and realizing the verbal abuse he took from all these REO agents and the persistence he had to have and all the negative comments, and he still had to write the offer because I was the client, and he'd fax it over, and he'd follow up and get beaten up more, and I just salute the man.
That is a tough day. There's an assumption, though, that the listing agent knows what their client will take. What's your comment on that?
I think that's sometimes true, but not always. They might have an idea. They may have a gut feeling. But I also know there's agents out there that absolutely know the bottom line, what will go to escrow and what won't.
Okay. But you constantly were asking anyway, because, I mean, that was John's job, is to ask the impossible daily and get a yes answer once a week.
Exactly. And I was going after properties in a very specific marketplace. So anything that was within that marketplace was fair game. Did not care who the listing agent was or what the story was. If it met my criteria, they were going to get an offer.
Okay. What was your criteria?
Within my marketplace, and whether it was a wholesale or a keeper or a retail house, depending on what I was shopping for. But if it fell within my 30-mile-long marketplace by 20 miles wide, that, first of all, if it fell in the marketplace, then I would, if it met my criteria for the houses that I like to deal with, typically between 800 square feet and 2,000 square feet, somewhere in that range, in a saleable neighborhood, skipping the bottom 20% of the market and skipping the top 40%, if it fell within that criteria, they got an offer.
What type of area? Now, I know you have a 20 by 30 mile radius, but you keep homes that are not necessarily in newer areas. So what is your favorite target rental?
My favorite target rental is, see, it's definitely not the newer areas. Some of the nicest areas that I deal in, like the city of Claremont, a lot of those neighborhoods were built out in the late 40s and early 50s to where the three-bedroom, one-bath, or the three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath, 1,200-square-foot stucco box, there's street after street of tree-lined streets, pride of ownership, totally in-demand stuff that are in great school districts. I'm looking for the location first, more important than anything, structure second. I will take a two-bedroom, one-bath house in an A neighborhood all day long before I take a three-bedroom, two-bath house in a B-plus neighborhood, because I know it's not the house that goes up in value, it's the dirt underneath it, so I'm a location shopper if I'm going to keep something for the long haul.
And where did you come to the decision that the size of the home shouldn't exceed 2,000 feet?
From a management standpoint, when the house gets too big, too many people move in, when you've got to paint it, that's a lot of paint. When you got to put the carpet in, that's a lot of carpet. I don't like second-story houses. I always use the license-insured roofer, but I know from a standpoint that second story costs a whole lot more than the first story does, and the paint job gets a lot more expensive. So over the years, I've narrowed down my criteria. I have had stuff less than 800 square feet, and I realize when the house gets too small, you get the transient-type people. When the house gets too big, you get too many kids. The wear and tear on the house, and between tenants, it's a lot of carpet.
You know, it's interesting that I asked you that question while we were in Texas, and everything that I bought as a rental mimicked exactly what you said would be wise.
And how did that work out?
It's perfect. And you know what? A lot of people went for the 3,000 square foot because it was less per square foot. It appeared to be a great deal, but they don't get any more rent. And
exactly.
They have more expense.
And that's a big piece of carpet.
And, you know, it is. That would be a big piece of carpet. The other thing is, and now on a downside in California, most of the price hit that we've seen so far has happened to inventory that's 2,000 square feet and above. It's not that it's not affected the smaller stuff, but that extra square footage has been discounted far in excess of the first 1,500 square feet.
Right, I agree with that, and it's really interesting this last time around in the building boom we went through. It's a totally different product than it was in the late 80s when the building boom. There was a lot of single-story ranch-style houses, track after track, built in the 80s, but in the 2000s, everything is two-story. They're the big 3,000-square-foot bumper-to-bumper boxes. They got as much house and as much height out of it as they could in as small a lot as they could possibly get away with.
Yeah, that's it's going to be interesting. They have auctions. I didn't when you looked at the LA Times, I'm sure you noticed the auctions that were coming up. They got about 1,150 to 1,200 houses advertised in the Sunday LA Times. One of them is very interesting. I'm sure they don't consult each other as when their auctions are, but they should. Because you have an REDC auction that's being held literally a week before a 600-house auction for Hudson and Marshall. I would think Hudson and Marshall is going to be without a few people.
Absolutely, and I've got both the catalogs sitting on my desk.
And then there's another one, Kennedy Wilson. I don't know if you saw that. They have three condo auctions that coincides with all the open houses and all the other auctions. And they have a different type of auction. They have what's called a minimum reserve, which is basically an absolute after the first number gets mentioned. And they have a condo price that's $75,000 in San Bernardino.
I know the complex.
Oh, okay.
I know that it's, I can't think of the name of it. It's off Del Rosa on the right-hand side, on the east side of the street.
I thought you were going to say you can't think of a worse piece of property.
I didn't say that.
Okay. But at any rate, they're now starting to cannibalize not only the agents and the MLS inventory, but themselves. There's too many properties simultaneously.
I was reading about the Florida condo glut, and I mean, those were just phenomenal numbers at the rate that they're getting absorbed at. They have a four-year supply of condos.
Now it's interesting. I read something that was completely different. This is just Miami-Dade.
Uh-huh.
At the pace of sale and the pace of, they also continued to build. So you have X amount that are already on the market. But I think this figure included what was already being constructed and would be done by the end of 2 years, which, you know, a high rise takes a while to build. So you're kind of stuck. They would have a 52-year supply.
52-year? Unbelievable. I know San Diego, they said they had like a 10-year supply with all the condo conversions and the condos they were building, but 52 years, unbelievable. And how cheap does that stuff go, and where does it stop?
Well, yeah, at some point someone holds an absolute auction, and I recall, we all know that Hemet, you and I know that Hemet condo project that would go for nothing because of a problem, but there was a condo that went for auction in the Canyon Crest area of Riverside, which is a pretty desirable area in the Poly District, and it went for $10,000.
That's amazing.
So, you know what, that's what's coming. What's your opinion of these auctions are going to have to say absolute here pretty soon?
Oh, they're absolutely going to have to get to the point of selling stuff absolute, and there are going to be some ugly days out there for lenders. I mean, I make the comment that we're in for probably the biggest transfer of wealth we'll probably see in our lifetime here, that there's going to be some absolute bargains out there, and I'm willing to take advantage of that stuff. When they let condos go for that cheap, I mean, that was part of the strategy I had for this upcoming market, was to get two types of property together, knowing that the fancy houses that I like to keep for rental houses most likely aren't going to cash flow, but there's going to be plenty of stuff out there that will cash flow, and if I pair those two together and push them forward, when we do finally recover from this market, I'm going to sell all the odd stuff and pay off the good stuff.
No, that's a great plan. My idea of going out of state, at least is starting to show some merit. It looks like I am, in fact, going to be trading each of those silly houses for a free and clear California one.
Which, I love that plan.
I'm glad I thought it up.
right. No, it's going to be the opportunity, absolutely, to do that. And I'm willing to take on stuff because it weird does not sell in this market. They're going to end up giving weird stuff away. It's going to go so cheap. But I also know what weird does at the top of the market. People line up to buy it to where I'm willing to take the weird really cheap, give a piece of the action away because I don't want to manage it, and then cash it out and, like I said, pay off the good stuff.
Now, your version of the piece of action would be to another gentleman in the business who rents it out, or would you be doing equity share to an owner?
Oh, no. It would be strictly from a management standpoint to where I haven't decided the amount I'm willing to give up, but it's somewhere between 10 and 20% of the...
This sounds like an advertisement.
Somewhere between 10 and 20%, but I'm not giving it away going out of the gate. I'm going to give them a contract for an option to where if they fulfill their management obligation the way we've agreed on, then at that point they will have an option to take a piece of the action. And if they just do management and don't fulfill their job, they'll probably be replaced by somebody else.
Do you see subject to buying playing a role in what you end up getting and keeping, or are you concerned about that?
What I'm getting in keeping, I don't see a problem with the subject two stuff. Where I see a problem is taking over subject two and then selling it to somebody else without disclosing everything and then having a loan called due, or doing a wraparound a loan that you've taken subject two and selling it and then having the underlying loan called due. From my standpoint of taking over something myself, no, I'm willing to roll the dice and risk that one. I've dealt with several of those over the years, but I have had three loans called due on me also. But I've taken over enough of them to where the three were a very small fraction of that to where I'm not that concerned about it.
Okay. I've had one, and then the lender backed off even after they filed notice of default.
Well, there was actually more than the three that called it due. I've had several of them, several more threaten me, and I played games with them or made minor concessions, written a small check, one thing or another, to work things out with them.
Okay.
And I've made interest rate modifications. I paid a point or two. There's whatever it took to work things out and not have to go to the bank and start from scratch.
What percentage of the houses that you buy, let's say in the next 4 years, will you that you keep, do you think you'll be buying directly from an owner as opposed to a lender?
I think much more of them are going to be coming from the lender, a much higher ratio. I'm going to say 3-4 to 1 probably.
Okay.
So I'm just guessing at that one. But looking back at the 90s versus the 2000s, and I'll never, ever be done dealing directly with sellers. I love to do one-on-one without anybody else involved there. And hands down, my best deals, the stuff that I've kept over the long haul, have came from dealing directly with sellers.
Now, did they get involved very often in financing that with carryback financing or no?
Sometimes. I'm going to say less than half.
Okay.
Less than half of my best deals were made for cash and usually non-financial motivation.
Absolutely. My favorite, too.
Right. I really dislike dealing with financial distress. I've done lots of it over the years, but I prefer not to. And looking at the bank repo inventory that I picked up over the years and kept, I went through my portfolio of rental properties, and there's only three bank repos that have met the criteria of long-term keeper properties, and two of those were followed from the default stage all the way through the process with the intention of keeping it. Only one property that I have that I buy as an REO that met my keeper criteria. I mean, people have the misconception that with all these bank repos that they're just putting out a half-price sale and come say, pick and choose and pay me half price for it. I've never had that experience with the banks. It's always been the problem property, solving a problem, getting paid well for it.
You just you said something a minute ago I wanted to ask. You had said that odd inventory doesn't sell in this kind of market. Does it rent?
Yes.
Okay.
Weird will rent.
Okay.
And until shelter goes out of style, weird will rent.
Do rents typically, while you have price declines and you've got tons of inventory for sale and people going into foreclosure, rents do what during that cycle?
Depends where you're at.
Okay.
In the valley that I operate in, rents absolutely go up. As soon as you go to the high desert, rents go down.
Okay. Now, why do you think that if people then physically remove themselves from the upper desert because of the drive and they come here?
Exactly. People... The high desert is very volatile. I remember it the last time around. It went down almost 45%. People go to where the affordable housing is, even meaning if they have to drive for an hour over Cajon Pass to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And once they're there, they have the American dream of home ownership. But as soon as they lose that house, they're not going to commute for an hour to be a renter up there. They're going to come back to the valley that they left from, which is going to leave an endless supply of houses in the high desert sitting vacant. And in order to rent those, there's an abundance of those. Absolute abundance of them.
Now, when you say the valley, are you speaking of even San Bernardino or specifically something like the,
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
San Bernardino is the eastern end of my marketplace. That's the 30 miles to the east. And even with all of the bank repo stuff there, I think there's still all of those people that lost houses are going to need a place to live, and they're going to be renting.
Okay, now I know that that's obviously the theory, and it sounds like it should work. And you have experience in renting, so that's why I'm asking you specifically. The vacancy rate doubles during the same cycle. And so, and that's just, you know, me and charts, so I know that that's true.
Okay.
I talked with a property manager, O'Neill Property Management, mm-hmm. and he said that his experience in Riverside, and I'm being very specific, said they went down last cycle during this time, and now they are already going down now.
The rentals?
The rentals are going down. He says what's happening is that we have maybe three times as many houses for rent that we did last year. People are going to keep them, but they're just trying to mitigate the monthly damage. And so now they're cannibalizing amongst themselves, trying to get whatever renter there is.
There will be a big shakedown of those people. They can only hang on so long and feed a big negative for so long before they're out of money.
Okay, so you're talking about maybe a year from now, and then 2 and 3 years from now, the rents do, in fact, take a hike, go up. Okay,
yes.
That makes sense. Property managers, have you ever hired one?
I've never hired a property manager. I bought too many properties from property managers and seen the state of affairs when I've taken over and never been really impressed with other people's management. I know that a check versus a financial interest in a property is a totally different mindset.
I think that's true. You apparently, though, you have the most efficient system in place, because, I mean, you're dealing with approximately 3 dozen rentals, and the time commitment that takes for you inside of a week is what?
A couple hours at the most, and I usually don't spend that much time, but if you average it out over the entire year, it's probably a couple hours a week.
Okay, let's talk about that, because that is going to be helpful for somebody in the future. I would imagine we're going to start holding some property. So location and type of home and school district, is that really vital to getting good people?
Absolutely. That is 100% it. You had made the comment about people doing whatever they can do to rent stuff and having 3 times as many rentals out there, but being a location shopper, people like to live in nice neighborhoods, and priced slightly below market rent, I get an absolute wonderful selection of people to choose from.
Okay. Now, once they move up the food chain to that's the person, you have an interview process that, what's that like?
It's an hour-long interview. We're absolutely going to share expectations and make sure that we're on the same page, to leave nothing to chance. I'm a very optimistic person, and I used to think that we were on the same page with everybody, and a couple of months into it, realize that no, I'm one place and they're a totally different mindset. So let's get that stuff out of the way now. I'm a firm believer. I'd rather have a vacant house than a bad tenant in the house all day long. Even if they're paying rent, I'd rather have a vacant house than a bad tenant.
What's the average length of the tenancy for your houses?
My average tenant right now is about 7 years. And I know that turnover is the number one thing that drives people out of this business, and that all starts with picking the wrong tenant. And a good friend of mine clarified some years ago for me, which totally changed my mindset about the way towards property management. And he said property management is completely not the right, that's the wrong term for what you're doing, that what you're really doing is you're maintaining a structure. You got to keep it maintained, but it's relationship management. And I realized that that's kind of like life, that all of your friends and people in your world, it's relationship management, and why treat tenants any different than that?
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it as I've got 3 dozen different relationships, a different relationship with every one of my tenants. We have the same goal in mind. I mean, I want the rent on the first in full and take care of the property, and what I'm really looking for is someone who's going to be a good steward of the asset that pays on time, and we're going to share those expectations and make sure we're on the same page before we start.
We only have time for one last question. How often do you get to see these tenants?
About a third of the tenants I interact with, we all see them a few times a year. Some of them like to bring the rent over, but the other two-thirds of them, I don't ever see these people. I have a 50-50 chance of picking them out of a two-man lineup. But I don't feel a need to visit with them. I drive past the house at least once a year, usually once or twice a year, and as long as things are maintained, the rent's coming in on time, and they're not complaining about anything, that I'm okay with that.
Yeah, why mess up a good thing?
Right, and I know some of the people really appreciate their little bit below market rent, and I have people that actually sneak the rent over to my office mailbox at night. I see them pull up when I'm working late, and they drive off.
They don't want to see you because they're afraid the sentence you'll say is like, "Oh, I got to raise your rent."
Exactly. They're like me as a buyer. Once I make a deal, I don't want to revisit the deal. Once they made their deal with me, they don't want to revisit me. Just pay the rent and comply.
Mike, thanks a lot for two great weeks of interviews. I really appreciate it.
Hey, not a problem, Bruce. I really enjoy doing it.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
On Saturday, November 10th, we'll be teaching selections from the California-only series for the Inland Empire Investor Forum. It'll be at the Eagle Glen Golf Club. And you can go to www.ieinvestorforum.com or call 951-898-1175 to sign up for that.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.